You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, August 23rd, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, my cold progresses deep through my body. I'm still standing. And also on the program, Sarah Canope and Jeff Bale, editors of Education and Capitalism, Struggles for Learning and Liberation, a series of essays on education and capitalism in this country. Also on the program, the little covered admission by the Romney campaign that their plan to save Medicare is to destroy Medicare. An admission. Also, new numbers out by the Pew polls on how the middle class is being hollowed out. A couple of interesting stories regarding Israel. I think I mentioned this the other day. I don't know if we actually covered it. Mexico. They've got universal health care. And, of course, the soon-to-becoming race war. It's at least a comfort in some way that fortunately, have some elected officials who are preparing for it, particularly down in Texas. I mean, when this goes down, we're going to be having to rely a lot on county officials, on elected judges to protect us in the oncoming. I'm not 100% clear if it's going to be a race war or if it's going to be the UN takeover of the country. Of course, nobody ever answers the question, why the heck would the UN want to take us over at this point? Right? I mean, these are the same people who are like, our debt is going to work bankrupt. China is going to, what? I mean, if there's such a problem, why would the UN all of a sudden want responsibility for this country? I guess maybe so that they could get all the gas that is being fracked, and then I guess they would export it, all this natural. But wait a second, that's already happening. Oh, I know why the UN would take over. Because what they want to do is they want to build a huge pipeline through the middle of the country, sort of taking some of the most viscous, horrible carbon source in the world, say like from Canada, like the tar sands, and they would want to ship this down through a pipeline that would go right down through the middle of the United States and then just ship it out to other countries, maybe refine it there. And of course, this process of refining is horribly damaging to the environment because it's a very sort of dirty source of petroleum. And of course, it would leak a lot through the pipeline through the middle of the country and probably screw up our water supply. And that's, of course, what they could call it, something like something XL or something, or I don't know, like Keystone, like UN Stone XL pipeline. And they could put it right through the middle of the country so it could damage our water supply and then also just send the profits for multinationals to other countries. That's probably why the UN would want to take us over. Right? I mean,
I can't think of any other reason.
Maybe that's why they would do it, or maybe they would just basically roll back the Clean Water Act, like create a loophole in the Clean Water Act so that fracking companies could come in and inject poisons into the ground, destabilize the ground so that it would create small earthquakes, and then inject basically poison. With the hopes that, the shale as it moves and it creates these earthquakes and these fissures, it could go in and ruin some watersheds. Maybe even they could, if they were really smart, what they would do is start fracking somewhere like in areas where it would destroy the water for like a major city, like a New York or something. Something to that effect. That would be an amazing plot by the UN. That's what they could do.
I have to say, it sounds like the UN is thinking in a very entrepreneurial, can-do sort of way.
Of course, that's the way that they work. They come in, and it's like they come in and just—I don't know. I mean, it's a scary prospect. It's just good to know. We'll talk more later in the program about these forces that are going to protect us when the UN comes. In the meantime, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Sarah Knopp and Jeff Bale.
I turned my camera on, I cut my fingers on the way, on the way, the waves slipping away. I turned my feelings on, you made me untouchable for life. Yeah, and you wasn't the light. It hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton.
Back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, I have Sarah Knopp. She is a high school teacher from Los Angeles, and Jeff Bale, assistant professor at Michigan State University. They are the editors of Education and Capitalism, Struggles for Learning and Liberation. Sarah, let's start with you. Tell me why you guys essentially put this book together.
There are a number of us teachers who are also activists who also believe that we really need that if we're going to protect public education in the United States, and not just protect it but also improve it and make it truly liberatory and make it truly about awakening people's potential, that we actually need to not just be teachers but also be activists in the community fighting for a different set of priorities coming from the politicians in terms of funding public education. So we wrote the book as a sort of appeal to other teachers to try to connect their pedagogy and what they teach to what they do in the community, and to join us in the fight in the streets for better public education, for a rethinking of the priorities of our states and of our country.
I mean, to a certain extent, Jeff, the argument is that the problem with our schools is essentially a reflection of a problem that we have with society at large.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. One of the sort of difficult things of thinking about schools and our capitalism is that there's a way schools are designed to function, which is basically to reproduce society the way it already exists in terms of massive class differences, and particularly targeting students of color and working class kids, and preventing barriers or posing barriers to them to advancing in life. At the same time, though, there's also a whole set of ideas about schools in our society that people believe in, particularly about schools being about democracy, schools being about equal opportunity. So there's sort of a way schools are designed to function, which butts up against many of the things they believe about how schools function, which is really ripe territory for social conflicts. And so if you look at U.S. history for the last 150 years, almost every single major civil rights battle that's happened, or civil rights struggle that's happened in our society, schools and the quality of education, access to education, has been a real central demand of those struggles. So it's both and. It's both that schools function in a way to keep society the way it is, but there's also all kinds of really important contradictions and opportunities to fight to make schools better.
All right. Well, so Sarah, let's start with the idea of Sarah, are you there? Oh, I think we lost Sarah. We're going to have to add her in a second. Jeff, are you still there?
I am, yep.
Okay. Well, I mean, just give me 1 second. Let me see if we can just add Sarah back into the conversation.
Sure.
I'm not exactly sure what happened there. Bear with us 1 second.
No problem.
Hello.
Hi, Sarah. So you didn't miss anything. So let's jump right into this. So I want to get to the ideas about schools. I mean, and Jeff has sort of set this notion up that the schools function in a couple of different ways within the context of a larger societal conflicts. But answer the sort of or address for me, if you can, the sort of the pragmatic question, and maybe it's not so easy, but are public schools, are they failing in their mission? And also, delineate for us what their mission should be or is, when you are answering that question.
Right. I think the most important thing to understand is that there are two kinds of public schools, or at least two kinds of public schools in this country. There are the public schools in well-funded, you know, suburban districts that function absolutely beautifully, like the one that I attended myself in Illinois. And then there are public schools in urban cores and rural areas with mostly students of color, where I think the powers that be really don't see those as children that they have any responsibility for, and those schools are the ones that we typically talk about as failing. Even in those schools, though, you often find, because I've worked in these kinds of schools for 13 years now, you often find a number of programs that are incredibly enriching for the students. You often find a number of teachers who the students really connect with and love, or sports programs, or things that, you know, really do genuinely help to improve the lives of students, even in those schools that are called so-called failing. But those of us who have taught there know that there are serious, serious structural problems in some of these underfunded schools that we have. But I think that rather than, I don't like to use the word failing, because I think, you know, as Jeff laid out, one of the essential missions of schools, whether this is conscious on the part of politicians or not, one of their essential missions is to sort of make sure that we have the kind of workforce that we need for the coming decade. And we know that what's happening in this country is that social mobility is decreasing and work is becoming increasingly de-skilled. Even the work of professionals is becoming increasingly de-skilled. And so when you have a workforce that doesn't is poorly paid and doesn't need critical thinking skills, the schools that we have right now actually function perfectly, and you know, to condition those sorts of workers. And we as teachers are sort of engaged in the battle to say, no, under any circumstances, critical thinking is important. And that's what, you know, we try to stand up for, and also stand up for through our unions that can help us to fight for more reasonable class sizes and more resources and so on.
And in many respects, and Jeff, you can answer this, but the new so-called school reform movement, which essentially is sort of applying corporate means of measuring success within the context of schools and across schools as a whole, is very much designed to achieve that goal of producing, I guess, I mean, how would you characterize it in terms of serving both that function of having people who are not critical thinkers essentially come out and providing them just the right amount of resources to function in that environment, and then also its negative effects on actual functioning of schools in the way that they should be functioning?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question, but there's a couple ways to get into it. So one of them is that if you look at any sort of reform coming from corporate America or from the corporate reformers, they paint all these reforms in terms of school quality and high educational attainment and good outcomes for students. I think they buy them a lot of political cover for the sort of reforms they're trying to push through. But I think it's important to understand they only really care about educational quality for a certain subset of American kids. So certainly for middle-class kids, they're very concerned about a high-quality education for folks to be able to get the sort of high-tech and knowledge-based economy jobs, all those kind of slogans that go with it. But part and parcel with those reforms is ramping up the sort of rationing of quality education and segregation within schools in terms of which kids get access to that quality education. That's part and parcel of any kind of corporate-based reform around educational quality. So you see, particularly in Michigan, where I live and work, how this ridiculous sort of contradiction plays out. Michigan has one of the highest per capita enrollments in terms of kids going to charter schools. And yet, as more and more schools are charterized and more charter schools drawn out to open, it's precisely those charter operators who are getting contracts to run schools who run some of the worst quality schools in Michigan, according to the state's own rankings, right? So in other words, they use the sort of red herring of school quality to be able to typically take over what used to be public neighborhood schools and run them for for-profit corporations. So it's happened that twice in Michigan. The first two cities in this country to completely turn over their school system to for-profit charter operators, it happened this summer in Michigan, one in Muskegon Heights on the west side of the state and one in Highland Park, just outside Detroit. And in both cases, the charter operators hired are for-profit companies who run some of the worst schools in the state. But that doesn't matter because these neighborhoods are primarily working class, primarily poor, and primarily African American. So quality education doesn't matter for those kids. You see some of the double play going on there with what quality means.
How is that sold to the public? I mean, if the state's own rankings show that these private school operators don't operate quality schools, do not create quality schools, how is it justified to hand over the school system to these for-profit companies?
Well, I think in a couple of ways. One, we can't tell any lies about the way public schools in Muskegon Heights or Highland Park were to begin with. So they weren't necessarily top quality schools at all,
right?
Partly because of decades of defunding, right? So the charter operators and the corporate reformers who go to bat for them in terms of politics, they're able to kind of pull on people's actual experiences in crappy schools, crappy public schools, and say, these folks can do a better job. Of course, the public record is never displayed at these sort of public hearings when these deals get kind of put in front of a particular community. But that's a really important part of it, that there are schools that are severely underfunded with a high turnover of staff, and they don't necessarily produce this sort of education that some parents want for their kids. The second part of it, too, this is particular to Michigan now, is that there's been for a couple of years now, and it's gotten worse under the new Republican governor, a law that basically allows the state to install what they call an emergency financial manager,
right,
which basically supersedes the city council, a school board, and all the rest of it. And that one person has the authority to make all kinds of unilateral
right.
decisions. And in both these cases, in Highland Park and Muskegon Heights, these were the decisions taken by an emergency financial manager. So you get, frankly, a fairly racist argument out there in the media that these majority black cities are completely undone by corruption and they didn't deserve democracy. That's part of the argument, that these communities do not deserve the right to run their own schools. Somebody has to come in and save them. And in one case, it's going to be the Leona Group, and the other case is going to be Mosaic Education. So I think that's how they get some political traction.
Right. I mean, I have to say that the dynamic here reminds me of the story of what happened with this Bruce Ratner development in the Atlantic Yards in Brooklyn. They bought up a chunk of the city in Brooklyn. They basically allowed the buildings to fail, and based upon the fact that these buildings were failed and empty because they had been bought, they would then got a permit from the federal government because they were able to designate these buildings as urban blight, which allowed them to take over the property and rebuild it. And it all sort of there's the same dynamic going on here with the schools. We starve these schools of resources based upon the problems that they have, and then that opens up the door for them to come in and be taken over by private enterprise. Sarah, when you talk about structural problems, I mean, as a teacher, you've obviously been exposed to this for 13 years. When you talk about structural problems, tell me what structural problems are there within your school. And also, tell me what you perceive as the implications of this new sort of testing regime as being the end all be all of whether or not a school survives or what kind of funding it gets, et cetera.
Yeah, okay, I'll just talk about a couple. It's funny because we've started school here in Los Angeles already, so I'm just, my next section of students is about to walk in the door in about 5 minutes here.
Okay.
There's gonna be 46 of them, walking into my 10th grade world history class. So I think if I had to pick, sort of one thing to highlight just first and foremost is it's very hard to teach critical thinking and to individualize an instructional plan when you have 46 students in your room. We find creative ways to do it, but it's very difficult. The second thing is this whole, I think the sharp edge of the sword right now is this sort of notion that you can judge a teacher based on their students' test scores. And so I would encourage everyone to look at the research of a Stanford scholar named Linda Darling Hammond, who really sort of debunks the myth that there's any validity whatsoever. I mean, first of all, we've already lost ground, the idea that you can measure the quality of education at all, even for the students based on their test scores, that's an argument that I think we lost 10 years ago, because really if you're teaching critical thinking skills and you're teaching skills, these are not things you can measure on a bubble test. Even beyond that, though, the very same teachers who score well, based on the value that they add, quote-unquote value that they add to their students' test scores, the very same teachers who score very well one year score very poorly the next year, and vice versa. And so, there really is no statistically valid way to measure a teacher based on their students' test scores. And then I've been teaching for 13 years, and I have never had one white student in my whole teaching career. And the levels of segregation that we have, I think, are just, they're staggering, and it's not even something that we talk about anymore. So those would be three that I would highlight: class sizes, segregation, and then what they're using right now to attack us, which is this idea that teachers can be measured on their students' test scores.
Now, I know you got to go because you've got class coming in, like you just mentioned, but if you've just got a minute. So essentially, is testing simply just a fig leaf? It's simply just a way to attack and essentially destabilize the union so that it would allow for more corporatization of the of schools?
I would say that high stakes multiple choice tests are being used in that way right now. And certainly it's connected to what Jeff was talking about earlier, where when you can create a crisis inside the public schools, that then gives you justification to privatize it. The only caveat that I would put on it is that all teachers want to evaluate our students, and all teachers love data, and we've invented all kinds of creative ways to look at our students' performance in the classroom and to really look at what our students are doing. And if they really cared about
measuring whether students are learning critical thinking skills and so on, they would ask teachers how to design evaluations and to gather real data, not this sort of, you know, multiple choice bubble test. We know what your value is based on your test scores.
So the issue is not testing, but rather how they're applied and how the results are used.
Right.
All right. Well, Sarah, I'll let you go because I don't want to stand in the way between.
Yeah,
the kids are
streaming in. We're back to school early here this year. So.
I understand. Well, thank you for the time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, and Jeff will stay with us, and we'll continue on with this conversation because I want to get a sense from you how get into the notion of how schools. Sort of, okay, so if the game plan is, at least from the reformers, is to impose this type of high-stakes testing regime, which will destabilize those sort of, I guess, power sources within schools as they stand now, within the education system as they stand now, weaken those so that there can be a greater sort of corporate takeover. Now, that takeover, I mean, I have to presume that it really is simply more about there's money to be made there, as opposed to if we can control the schools, we can create the type of worker drones we want. I mean, there's nobody sort of like with that agenda. I think it's just sort of like it's really just a matter of. Well, and maybe there's one other factor. One is, I would imagine, a desire because, look, there's money to be made there, just like there is in prisons, for that matter. And two, being there is schools, public schools represent a huge ideological problem, particularly for conservative and reactionary forces in this country, because it's about as socialistic as you can get.
That's absolutely right, Dan. So let me, the couple questions in there. Let me just pick up on one thing Sarah was saying before she had to leave, which is about like the idea that teachers do support certain forms of testing. The main idea, this also goes back to your question earlier, like how do they get away with these sort of attacks? That oftentimes they take what would otherwise be good educational practices and turn them into their opposite. Right? So the idea of having useful, data-driven ways to understand how students learn so we can improve our instruction, that I don't think any teacher would ever be against, right? But that actually gets turned on its head as a way to rank and sort schools, shut schools down, fire teachers, and all the rest of it. And you can go through any number of things about curriculum reform and teacher evaluation reform that are based like that. I spent 9 years in the classroom myself and never had a satisfactory observation or evaluation from an administrator. And that experience, I think for many teachers, does encourage them to get behind the idea of more systematic evaluation processes. At the same time, those evaluation reforms that are going on are absolutely about being able to break the union by ending tenure, right? So oftentimes these are good ideas get turned on their head. In the process of doing that, though, they bring along people who otherwise have progressive ideas around school. So it makes it a pretty complicated political terrain. Their question, though, about what their goals are, I do think there are certain level of corporate reformers or the kind of reformers who do actually want a certain part of society simply to be worker drones. And if not that, but to have a pretty clear school to prison pipeline set up for, particularly for students of color, particularly for African American males. So that the function of schools in doing that can't be overlooked, right? They can't say that publicly, but I think it does function in that way. But the last thing you said about the ideological problem is absolutely right. There's a problem for conservatives around schools around demanding local control. That tradition in the U.S. school system that every single community has the right to elect their own school board, elect their own curriculum, and really run their own schools to match the values and the aims of a local community, that runs up headbutts up really against the particular conservative corporate reform of being able to mass test schools, mass rank schools, and maybe sort of broad structural changes. I think some of the some of the conflicts ideologically are coming to the fore, which allows things like the battle happening in Chicago with the Chicago Teachers Union. It's allowed that to come to the forefront really in a pretty sharp way, because more and more people see that the promises of these reforms and the reality of these reforms are polar opposites in almost every case.
You know, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, not to spend too much time on it, but this notion of creating these worker drones. I mean, my daughter goes to public school here in New York City, and one of the most, I guess, prominent charter schools in the country is the Success Academy. I think it was in Waiting for Superman.
Yeah.
And that same outfit opened up a success school in my daughter's public school district. Now, this is a public school that is considered one of the better ones in the city. In fact, you know, it was they had 35% more applicants than they could hold when my daughter came in as a kindergartner. I mean, there was literally a lottery to get into the school, yet. Resources are being taken away from expanding that school and creating a second public school for a success school in a district where we obviously have a very good school. And, you know, I didn't really contemplate trying to send my daughter there, but I did have conversations with other people. And one of the knocks about these schools are, and it's interesting because depending on what sort of socioeconomic background you come from, it's whether or not you can afford to even have this type of critique. But we had parents who said, I had conversations with our parents who said, like, you know, I've seen the curriculum there. I've seen kids there, and it creates, it's extremely rigid. It teaches these kids essentially to show up on time and to do certain things. But it does not allow for a lot of creative thinking, a lot of questioning of authority. It is extremely rigid, and it is setting these kids up to work, to function within very narrow confines. I mean, to take orders in some ways. And
yeah.
Now, from a critique from a upper middle class or an extremely wealthy white family on the Upper West Side of New York City, I don't want my kid to be in that rigid of a situation. And then, you know, people go and spend $40,000, $50,000 a year to send them to a private school, which allows for a lot more freedom.
Right.
Whereas if I am from a socioeconomic strata that is poorer, I am from a if I am African American and don't have the same opportunities, particularly in the context of Manhattan or wherever, the idea that maybe my kid is going to go to a school like that and it's going to get put them on track to go to a better, let's say, higher education, or to get in a position where they can get a scholarship or higher education because they go through this process and the test scores look good. There's some value there, but it is there another option, in other words, that we can offer for people in that type of socioeconomic situation? Is there another option besides drone track?
Yeah. No, there absolutely is, but there's no shortcut to it. So I'll come back to that in a second. But there's a couple of things I think that are assumed, both in sort of why parents would line up and flock to a charter school like that and hope against hope that their kid gets in, but also probably behind the question, too. And the idea is that it's because of a high-quality education, one that nurtures creativity and creative thinking and thinking and divergent thinking and all that. It's because of that that one finds economic success or prosperity as an adult. And that actually isn't the case. So the sort of, in most cases, most often the sort of economic prosperity that one enjoys is more often the consequence of their upbringing and their background. In other words, not in terms of moral upbringing, but in terms of the sort of class background their parents have. And that reality of of in most cases, most of the time, that our status in society gets reproduced generation after generation, that reality gets turned on its head to believing that if we just either work hard enough at work or work hard enough at school to get ahead, then we can go from being extremely poor to at least being middle class or being even wealthy. There is a layer of people for whom that is true, and again, that kernel of truth to that claim, I think, does instill a lot of hope in people that their kid might be the next one that can break through, that can be a border crosser, as one of the terms kind of used in this particular field of research describes them. Kids are able through education to go from being poor, working class, to middle class, or even wealthier. But for the vast majority of kids, it isn't the type of education you got, it's the class background, the social background of your family that has a lot to do with shaping where you're going to end up in life. Which then says that what the other option is, that the moments in time historically when there has been much greater social mobility, either through schooling or through work, have been basically one of two cases have held. Either there have been broad social movements, particularly around fighting for expanded civil rights, and that have taken the issue of segregation and rationing at school very seriously. Those are the moments when you've seen schools right across the country transform in terms of quality, in terms of culturally and linguistically relevant schooling and curriculum and all of that. And the other instance has been when there's been a strong labor movement that's been able to sustain living wages for working class people. That there was a moment in history, in U.S. history, when both those things sort of lived side by side for the 25 or 30 years after World War II. But that era is long gone. It's been a 30 or 40 year campaign to beat back all those gains, and now we're left fighting over the table scraps in terms of which few number of kids are going to be able to break out of a bad neighborhood or a poor neighborhood or under-resourced neighborhood in an urban environment and break through. That, by design, by definition, can only be a tiny minority of kids. And so most of our energy is directed to fighting over those opportunities versus saying, wait a minute, why doesn't every kid get to have an awesome education? Why doesn't every kid get to have a full curriculum and a fully resourced school? Any questions like that?
Right. And so what, you know, in light of the fact that 30 years later, that the sort of, I guess, the undercutting of those power bases for the middle class. And, of course, we have to say that, you know, the fact of the matter is that while 40 years ago or so we had unions and we had a stronger middle class, that was not necessarily a benefit that redounded to citizens across racial and gender spectrum, I guess. And but with that said, knowing that we have less of those power bases, and we have less of an opportunity for that we've sort of like almost in some ways we've created these charter schools are now sort of functioning almost like in the same way as, you know, if my kid's a great football player, they can go and get a scholarship and go to a great college in some way, you know, sort of like some type of almost like lottery that is based also in some way on their capacity to fit into a pre-existing program. What is the answer? I mean, what are the answers, or what is the larger program that can sort of what's the option?
Well, I mean, there is no like quick and easy solution to it, which I think is what makes things like charter schools and pretty much every typical reform you see out there so sort of sexy for the media and for pundits, is that they seem like quick fixes, right?
Right. Well, Superman, so right? We're just waiting for Superman.
Yeah, precisely, right? And if it doesn't come in the form of the right teacher, basically an elite kid from Yale goes to Teach America for a couple of years, if it doesn't come in that form, then it's going to come in the form of the right kind of teacher evaluation, or the right way to figure out which teachers to fire, or the right kind of textbook. So these kind of easy solutions are on offer all the time, and unfortunately, there really aren't any. So what it takes is the much more complicated but much more effective process of teachers and parents and other community members figuring out what sort of resources, what sort of programs, what sort of curricula are needed in a given school to make that school relevant, successful, meaningful for those kids. And so you've seen, I think, bubbling up over the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, maybe even a decade, really in the wake of No Child Left Behind, sort of the high-stakes program for testing that sort of imposed across the country, you started to see these sort of coalitions that aren't just about teachers around a specific classroom or workplace issues, but teachers organizing with parents around precisely the situation you described with your daughter. All of a sudden, in a school system that says for years, we have no money and resources to make that school better, all of a sudden they can give up the entire third floor for a new charter school. That happens overnight, right? And the kind of movements, the one in New York I'm thinking of particularly is the grassroots education movement. And there are many of these types of things that have sort of bubbled up around the country that are modeled, I think, of what it means to organize the sort of struggle that should require to transform schools both from the inside and from the outside. And like I said earlier, what's burning in Chicago really, I think, has the potential to be a game changer at a national level for a number of reasons. One, for the labor movement writ large. I mean, teachers are the single largest unionized workforce that's left in this country, right? But that alone, the fact that the third largest school system, the third largest teaching force is basically, you know, about to go on strike. I mean, they called for a vote for a 10-day notice, whatever the terminology is, in a particular contract, and turning that 30,000 signs, they are ready and waiting if they need to go on strike and are able and willing to do so if they're forced to. But the only reason why CTU has been able to get to that position is because they have spent several years building this sort of parent-teacher community alliances and students as well to be able to understand the sort of solidarity and common interests that teachers and community members have. Too often, teacher interests and student interests are counterposed. In fact, Michelle Rhee used to run the school system that worked for so long in D.C. public schools. Her big argument has always been that teachers focus too much on what's good for the adults and not what's good for the kids. So she's been more the mastermind at trying to counterpose adult and student interests, but in fact they're one and the same. And the organizing that the CTU has been able to pull off over the last few years is a model for how that can happen, not just at a school level or a neighborhood level, but at a city level, that has the potential to change the political conversation really about schooling in this country.
And I would also add that's also a great model for the way that labor unions should be functioning across the country, even outside of teaching. You know, the idea that that unions need to begin to represent the interests of labor as opposed to their unions, and find solidarity with other workers outside of the people that they represent directly, because ultimately they need to create an awareness that on some level the union is representing far greater interests than just those who happen to be members. Jeff Bale, thank you so much for taking the time. The book is Education and Capitalism, Struggles for Learning and Liberation. Forgive me for my cold today, but we will it was great talking to you too, and we have a link to your book at majority.fm. Thanks for taking the time today.
Excellent.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye now.
Again, I want to apologize for my cold today, folks. It's left me a little bit foggy. And we're going to head into the better half of the program.
Gawker just released like a whole like trove of Bain documents.
Really?
Yeah, like 950 documents.
Gawker did?
Yes.
Where did Gawker get them?
I don't know.
What exactly is in this trove?
There's literally like 5 or 6 blog posts dedicated to each one so far, and they're still going through it.
And what exactly are they saying?
Cayman.
You got to speak up, buddy.
Cayman Island tax dodging schemes.
What? No. No way. Won't believe it. No way. No how. No.
Surprise.
Okay, what else? Cayman Island tax dodging schemes. Well, we'll go through this in the better half of the program, folks. And I'm sure that, assuming I don't completely collapse between now and tomorrow, Cliff and I will go through this as well. But we're going to head into the better half of the program. Folks, can you please become a member of the Majority Report so I can go out and get some type of medicine? It is your dollars that make it possible for me to go out and buy cough suppressant and nasal decongestant and zinc tablets and medicated tissue so that I don't get a chafing on my nose. It is your majority.fm support, which allows me to go and keep myself hydrated every day. So please, if you can, support the program in that way. There are other ways to support the program, but none of which will allow me to buy any of those medications. You can buy your Amazon junk through our Amazon link at majority.fm/support-the-show. You can buy Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop, coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, organic. Coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. You can buy the Majority Report blend. Of course, we have merchandise. You can give us a review on iTunes, donateyouraccount.com, subscribe to us on YouTube, many other ways, but becoming a member is the best of all of them. When we go into the better half of the program, I will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me. I'm firing up the IM machine right now. You can IM me at Majority FM or MajorityFM at Jabber.org. Both works. And we'll see you on the better half. I may have to cut it a little bit early today because I'm getting a little bit... oh, I'm still sick. I don't know what to tell you. You know, but does that keep me from delivering you tremendous content? Introducing you to a myriad of ideas? Some days, but generally not, no. All right, we'll see you in the better half.